Hi, everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of Media Voices. I'm your host, Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
Full house. So, Esther, who have you been talking to this week?
So, this week I spoke to Charlie Beckett. He's the professor at LSE and is leading their Truth, Trust and Technology Commission. I'm going to make sure I get that the right way around. We spoke at length about the role of platforms in defining truth, like whether media literacy is a good or a bad thing, and whether we can still use the term fake news as a helpful definition. It's a really long interview, and what you'll hear shortly has been brutally cut. So listen out at the end of the pod for how you can get hold of the full version.
Fantastic. But ahead of that, as ever, we're going to go into our news roundup. And good news, and I think it's symptomatic of where the industry's going. Once focused on scale, Hearst is cutting back on aggregation and viral fluff. So Digiday are at it again with a good look at how Hearst is putting up its hands, doing a mea culpa and admitting it was guilty of chasing scale at the expense of original reporting. So back in January 2017, only one of the company's top 50 stories included some research or reporting or both, said Kate Lewis, who's their SVP and editorial director of Hearst magazine's digital media. Does this surprise anybody that Hearst were one of the people who were really chasing scale?
What I thought was interesting about the story wasn't that they were changing the way they were doing things. It was they admitted to not having that original reporting and original content in there in the first place. I mean, we all sort of knew about it. Not at Hearst particularly, but everywhere. Mm. Remember the articles that were in the Press Cadet about people bailing because they were just doing cut and paste jobs and stuff. So we all knew this was going on, but it's only the fact that she's talking about this with these actual numbers that we can say, oh, this is what Hearst was doing.
Yeah, it's interesting. Actually, now you've mentioned that, I can't think of anybody else who admitted that they weren't doing original reporting. You've heard people say, you know, maybe we were chasing scale to an extent that we shouldn't have been, but you never hear people say, oh, it's because we were sort of abandoning that which, you know, people think of when they think of quality journalism.
Yeah, so I think the honesty in this is fantastic. I love it. And I think, you know, the other side of that is I'm really, really glad that the trend, hopefully this is a trend, is away from viral fluff, which is such a brilliant headline.
It's a horrible image.
It wasn't until you said that.
By December of last year, 28 of Hearst's top 50 stories had research or original reporting. And if you compare that to only one of the company's top 50 back in January, that's a hell of a change. And
definitely.
But here's my question to the both of yous. Is this a chicken and the egg situation? Are audiences now hungry for that original exclusive content, or are publishers recognizing that scale is a bit of a dud, and so they're doubling down on it, pushing it more, and that's why we're seeing it pop up more in Hearst's most read features? What's the causality here?
I've got a theory on this. I think that it was fairly evident from sort of what summer last year that Facebook was not heading in the viable direction for publishers. You know, social publishing at scale and reaching millions and millions of people has always been tough. And I think Hearst are probably a bit ahead of the game in this. And they've kind of said, well, look, you know, we can't monetize that scale. If you reach 3, 4, 5 million people, so what? Jolly good. But the way to make money, and this is where a lot of the decent publishers have gone now, is to say, right, you know, we actually need to focus on content that the audience cares about. And when I spoke to Corey Hake at Mike last week, she said, you know, you've got to create content the audience care about. And that requires time and attention and, you know, money. You've got to spend money to make it. You don't click on an article and expect a curation of sort of funny Twitter content. It just doesn't work. It doesn't make you anything, and it doesn't foster audience loyalty.
The issue with this, I'm sure it's in this article, where there was no sort of metrics yet to say whether this was actually delivering on an engagement level from an advertising point of view.
Mm. Well, it mentions that they are, you're right, they're moving to less of a sort of hit-based thing and more time spent. But it's early days yet, you know, that you wouldn't necessarily expect them to have this figure.
Time well spent.
Yeah. We love time well spent. This podcast is time well spent.
You can, they're already listening to it. You can stop pitching it.
Oh, sorry.
There's a really good quote from Kate Lewis, actually, at the end of the article. She says that the noise of the internet is at peak, and unique angles, original content can help break through that noise. And so the author's piece ends by saying that it's still up in the air whether original reporting will be beneficial to business models. But while it is expensive, doesn't the drive towards memberships and subs kind of demand that people invest in this at this point? You cannot rest on Twitter roundups and Twitter aggregations. Doesn't it kind of require that people now spend money to generate and produce this kind of original quality content?
Yeah, because it's got to be about differentiation.
Exactly.
You know, there's a, I can't remember if it was Ev, Twitter, Medium, man.
Yeah.
He wrote that rationalizing thing.
Yeah.
Rationalizing publishing. And I'm sure it was him that said in there that, you know, what happened when we all went to ad-funded models was that we didn't actually realize that we were getting into this commodity market, and that moving back to subscriptions, as Medium is doing, is all about differentiation again. It's all about brands and about original content and original reporting, different takes. So the information is charging people $300 a year because it does a very definite thing. It gives people tech news, but in a very certain way. It's not flooding them. It's giving them, you know, I don't know, two or three original pieces a day, but it's pretty solid stuff. So I think differentiation is the point with all of this.
Moving on then, Netflix spends more like a media company than a tech company. Peter, you flagged this story up. What is it about?
Well, they did better than expected numbers on subscriptions, I guess. They signed 7 million new subscribers in the first quarter of this year, 26 million net new over the previous 12 months for a total of 125 million subscribers, which is, you know, serious going.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing, and what they're talking about is them spending like a media company, is they've spent about $10 billion on content and marketing, as opposed to $1.3 billion on technology. Mm. And they're, you know, the CEO, Reed Hastings, is talking about that in relation to being a subscription business rather than being an ad-supported business, that spending on content is really what is keeping the subscriptions coming in.
Well, I mean, to be sustainable, they have to make this investment in content. So it's sort of Reed Hastings is glossing over the fact that increasingly studios and distributors are seeing Netflix as more of a competitor. And we're seeing places like Disney pull all their content off Netflix. So Netflix have to invest in this original content if they want to have, you know, guaranteed content in the future. What some of the figures are crazy. Like, they want to have 50% original content by, what, 2020? Maybe even before then. Because they know that they're increasingly going up against the traditional distributors. So it's not necessarily whether it's sustainable as a model on its own. It's that it definitely won't be sustainable unless it invests all this money.
But again, it's that kind of, I don't want to say chicken and egg again, but I am going to say it, chicken and egg. If they don't spend the money, they won't get the subscribers. But if they don't get the subscribers paying the money, they won't be able to afford the content. So is the whole thing sustainable?
Do they need to spend? Because it is very similar in the Spotify model. Spotify has done very, very limited inroads into kind of original stuff. I think they've launched a podcast. I mean, they're not profitable either, so it's maybe not the best example. But Spotify have that kind of that middle tier that if you don't want to pay for their service, you get the ads. And I wonder if that kind of thing, I know Netflix are very, very anti-ads for kind of the user experience, but if they had kind of like a middle tier where they could monetize that base of people who don't want to pay and make some ads from that, I wonder if that would be a better way for them. Because, like, I don't know if they need the original content or whether that's...
But ad spending on television, at least in the US, has actually hit a plateau. You know, I read an article not too long ago that said it's in permanent freefall now. It is in permanent ad money recession. So, because in part, everybody's cord-cutting and everybody's going to these OTT services like Netflix, like Hulu. And I think another reason that they're investing so much is something we spoke about earlier in the podcast, is differentiation. Mm. Is that they need all this original content so they can say, we are the channel that has Stranger Things, Peter, that has, you know, Neo Yokio, the bizarre Jaden Smith thing. I mean, I think it makes sense for them.
I think it makes sense for them too. I just wonder when you've got a cash shortfall of what, $4 billion, how sustainable
is
that?
Introduce a second tier.
Yeah, you're just cheaping out. You're just cheaping out so you can watch the next season of The Crown.
But actually, it would be a really interesting cost experiment whether they would make more from my $5.99 a month subscription, or whether they would make more if I ended up watching more on a free ad-supported model. whether they'll actually make more for advertisers. Advertisers are clamouring to get on this sort of thing. It's, like Chris said, like traditional cable TV streaming ads are not working.
Are you listening, Mr. Reed Hastings? You know, I never took you as the sort of advocate for the ad industry, but that's about three podcasts in a row. You have been pitching the ad-funded model.
It's she's a millennial, Peter. She wants stuff for free, you know. And
I think I need a break.
But then, just as a final point on this, I'd be interested to see what you both think of this, is that Netflix is reportedly looking to buy a chain of cinemas because that gets it sort of automatic entry into awards categories. You know, it will be able to determine what gets shown, and if it shows its original shows and stuff on legit theaters, then it will be eligible for Oscars, it'll be eligible for BAFTAs, it'll be eligible for all this sort of stuff.
I think the ruling around that is really, really unfortunate. I think it's really, really sad that they preclude Netflix from that. It's like, guys, this is the 21st century. Yeah. Some of the stuff they produce is superb. I did watch a couple of episodes of Black Mirror. I was like, this is world-class stuff they're producing. And just because they don't conform to the traditional model, it's like, grow up.
No, absolutely.
Yeah, I agree.
It is. I think that we're all in agreement on that it is. It's protectionism.
It's like precluding part. Digital ads because they didn't appear in a magazine. It's like, well, that's how most people consume it these days. So I get with the times.
Yeah, so certainly. So Media Voices, final word on that is get your act together, Hollywood. So moving on then, Facebook's local news initiative shows early signs of not working. I know. So even by its own standard of measuring engagement through that meaningful interactions piece of fluff, not viral fluff, but whatever that means, Facebook's push to prioritize local news publishers appears to be a bit of a dud, according to Tau Center research. So CGR, Pete Brown, writing for CGR, reports that interactions with 13 local news publishers has actually fallen since the algorithm change, down from 211 interactions per post to 153. So, and the one positive standout was Philly.com, whose interactions skyrocketed. Although, that's probably because the Philadelphia Eagles won the Super Bowl this year. Go Birds. So, I mean, is the answer here then that all local news sites have to have a Super Bowl-winning sports team in order to save their business?
I've got a counter question to that, actually. If you have fewer interactions, but they're from local people who are more relevant, mm-hmm. are they not more valuable to you? You know, if they go down from 2 billion worldwide interactions to 100 actually local people, okay, it's a bit silly, but is that not more of more value to them?
I also think there's an issue here in terms of, is it, you know, Facebook and local content? Do people go to Facebook for local content? Probably not. Could they in the future? Yeah, probably, but that's going to take time, and that's going to be all about the interface and how it's presented in the feed. That's not just going to happen overnight.
No, because at the moment, as we've said in the notes, I don't necessarily think that people go to Facebook as is for local news content. I think that they go there for friends and family content, and if they just happen to be in the same sort of geographical location, then that shouldn't count as local content.
Also, like, Marketplace took quite a long time to pick up when it launched, and now like Marketplace is everywhere. It's rolled out worldwide. Mostly worldwide. That's like a familiar thing now.
Do you remember when we were at media briefing and there's a lady came in? She worked for one of the media briefing's farming titles.
Yeah, I know exactly the conversation you're saying.
Yeah, she spoke about a local news group on Facebook where she basically said everyone went there for local news, for events, for road closures, for all sorts of stuff. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a habit forming thing there that could work.
So, I mean, it's, if we were to play armchair CEO then, what would you do if you were Campbell Brown, what would you do in order to boost that visibility of local news in a way that made it interesting to local people?
Forgive me for plugging into Zuckerberg's community bullshit, but I couldn't even say it
without using the word bullshit.
I think the secret to this is not necessarily, it is absolutely the news partnerships, but it's also groups. It's local groups. It's about getting individuals involved with top tier local information, because that's where you're going to get your engagement. That's where you're going to get a feel for what that audience is actually interested in. It's where you're going to get people building that habit to finding that local content. So yeah, armchair CEO, merge local groups and local news initiative. Boom.
Boom, solved.
I think if I was Campbell Brown, by the way, I'd probably resign and go and get an easier job, because she's got to have the worst job in America.
She absolutely does.
But the other one was the quote from who leads, I can't remember the guy's name, but he leads the Google News partnerships.
Mm.
And it was like he was saying he felt sorry for her because at least he can get stuff done.
Yeah.
And she's got no chance because the product teams are just like, forget it.
Well, Esther, you've been ahead of the curve on what, you know, they are doing around local for quite some time. It's just, this is...
I'm still holding out for them to make a move in Torrio this year. That will come true at some point.
Yeah. I agree. I think so. So do you think then, Esther, as our Facebook local expert, that this is an early wobble, or do you think this is something that's kind of more existential to their local journalism plans?
No, because I'm in the group that are developing this, their journalism project, and I actually think this time they're making little changes, cautious changes, and they are kind of doing it in a bit more in collaboration with publishers. Those are going to be famous last words because they're going to spectacularly screw this up. But I kind of have the feeling that they're doing this very cautiously, very slowly, and it's not going to be like a big boom, here's local news, go out and embrace your hubs. So, yeah, I think the idea of integrating community groups, which are, like, they're really, really powerful in my local area, but it also kind of needs to be like a two-way thing, because people love getting involved in things and people need to feel like they can contribute to that community hub, their local hub as well. But I think those realizations and those changes are going to come. They just need to come slowly and in association with publishers. And if part of that is saying to publishers, put your content in here, you know, nominate a local advocate and we'll pay your carriage fee, then that might well be the way forward. And they need to come to that realization in collaboration with the people they're working with. So I think it's very early days. So this week I spoke to Charlie Beckett, who is leading LSE's Truth, Trust and Technology Commission. And I start off by asking him how the commission came about and what work he's been doing as part of it.
The LSE does these big commissions, where it did one on economic growth and gender inequality, where they don't try to solve all the problems, but they try to come up with an agenda. And the important thing is to try and bring together academics, obviously, not just from the LSE, but perhaps most important, policymakers, practitioners, who are making big decisions all the time. And it's to try and obviously make some recommendations about how we can improve public information. Some of those might be about, I don't know, regulation. Some of them might be about what should companies do. And you hope this will at least provoke thinking. And in some ways, perhaps the most important thing can be to define the problem. I think we've seen so much overreaction, really, to different elements. Cambridge Analytica, Mark Zuckerberg, fake news. Everyone thinks there's bad stuff happening and something must be done. And in a way, it's quite important to step back a little bit and say, well, what is the problem you're trying to solve before you start bringing in new laws or rules? Because especially when you're talking, I think, about news and, you know, democracy, but also people's sort of free expression on social networks, you are dealing with very complex and important, you know, sort of open rights that people have. And the last thing you want to do is for that to backfire. I mean, this all started a couple of years ago when I was in the States after the American elections. Donald Trump had been elected, on comes Brexit. We're quite shocked by, you know, as journalists, we're shocked by things happening that we didn't expect. And then, of course, the media itself coming under fire. And so there was a kind of panic reaction, you know, stop this fake news. This fake news must be causing all these bad things. And, of course, since then, we've got much better at trying to define what we mean by fake news. You know, it's the crazy stuff, but there's also propaganda. And there's also disinformation that is a deliberate attempt not to convince you to believe in something, but just to stop you thinking that anything can be true. And generally speaking, this is really bad for business. It's bad for journalism. It's not very good for politicians in the end. And it's not good for, you know, society in general, for business, for education. And I'd argue, most importantly, it's not good for voters or the public. If you can't trust stuff, if you don't know what is quality or reliable or credible information makes it much harder for us to live our lives. We also get, frankly, gets rather stressed out. You know, there's a lot of evidence that people find all this overabundance of material and a lot of, you know, aggressive, angry, hostile stuff. They find that disturbing. You know, our commission is definitely looking at ways that you can change, I don't know, terms and conditions, rules and regulations, even perhaps laws. But on the other hand, it's also about, I think, just trying to help people, setting up systems that help people to identify, first of all, and then get access to good information. And that's almost about building capacity.
And what are the sort of key outcomes been so far, or is it still a bit early?
Still a bit early, but I think some of those, you know, funny little debates have shifted. So, for example, a year ago, the debate was, are the platforms publishers? It was a really boring debate. It was a bit like, you probably remember, you might not remember, there was an old debate about, are bloggers journalists? So it was a kind of, you know, guys, we're missing the point. It's important to think about definitions, but, you know, it was a kind of false distinction. And I think we can obviously see now that the platforms, you know, including Google, of course, and YouTube and all the rest, are acting in ways that is shaping information. They're editing stuff. We're telling them to. We're saying, get that terrorist stuff off your networks. And they're doing it. You know, Facebook has now hired thousands of people to edit their network. So that feels familiar. But they are not the same as a news organisation. You know, they may start to create some content, but they have quite a different function. In many ways, news organisations are wonderfully controlled. We can see what we're going to publish. We can choose that. And yes, we're driven by our audiences. We're driven by audience data. We respond to that. People make journalism go viral. But at least we got control over our content and our responsibilities and our liabilities. I'd argue it's much harder, actually, for Google search, and especially with Facebook, because they're organic. You know, they don't pick and choose all the stuff. And the algorithm, you know, the AI responds to, it can shape it, but it responds to what people do. Facebook doesn't create any fake news. It's people on Facebook that might create or spread fake news. So they are different, and that means, you know, the regulation, if there's going to be any, has to be done differently. And the problem, you know, might be different. It might be that you think they're just too big. Some strange concepts flying around. And then I think, you know, obviously we're academics, so we love to sort of question, what do we mean by it's more complicated, all those phrases that academics like. But it really is. And I think, you know, that whilst the issues feel very pressing, I don't think that we need to charge into great big new rules and regulations. I mean, it is happening in this country. The government has said we're going to have an internet charter. They're having an inquiry into news. We've got the Select Committee report on fake news is going to come out in the next few months. And also the other side of it, you know, the other interesting thing is hearing from news organisations are having to make big decisions. Should they be on Facebook? Should they adopt a subscription model? What data should they be gathering and using? Because, of course, wonderful thing about running newsrooms is they've all got these new people, data officers, engagement officers. Well, they're doing something similar to Facebook. They're using the data about their audiences to give them better news, but also to flog them stuff. And also, we've just got to make sure that anything we do come up with is, you know, dreadful cliche, but future-proof. Because things are, this is really annoying.
It's not even possible.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you're covering this all the time, but, you know, we're trying to do a commission that is going to report in the autumn, and we've already accepted that whatever we say is going to be provisional, because not just the debate's shifting, but the technology's shifting. You know, we can see the increasing use of closed messenger apps, for example.
I mean, the issue shifts so quickly. When we scheduled this, Cambridge Analytica had only just broken.
Yeah.
That's completely transformed the conversation again.
Yeah. And in some ways, the Cambridge Analytica thing is a bit of a distraction. It is an allegedly dodgy company that broke rules. Okay, Facebook didn't manage it particularly well, it seems. And it is symptomatic of problems that are going to come up in the future. But how much, you know, is this a dodgy one-off? or is it systematic?
So the term fake news has been around for about, what, it's about a year and a half old in popular terms now. In terms of sort of picking apart what that means, do you think that's actually a helpful term now, or is it kind of gone over and above what it actually is, was it intended to mean?
My academic colleagues, quite rightly, people like Claire Wardle from First Draft, quite rightly say you can't use it anymore, in the sense that because people like Donald Trump has used it just to mean news I don't agree with.
Yeah.
And it really has been used by very dodgy people all around the world. You just have to say fake news with some if you're accused of anything. However, I still use it, if only as part of a conversation, because what's remarkable is it resonates out there with real people. They are conscious that there's something. We've always been suspicious. We've all been cynical. We always said, you know, you can't trust the newspapers. But I think people do feel that there is this new amplification through social networks especially, but also it's chimed in with other factors like the sort of growth of kind of populism. You know, even things like, you know, Brexit, even things like, you know, Momentum and Jeremy Corbyn. I'm not suggesting he's fake news, but I just meant that people using social media to in a political way. So the kind of fake news thing resonates, but it's really important that we do define it better, that we understand it's about misinformation, disinformation. It can be about satire. But it does matter. And this is why, you know, when Diane Abbott tweets out a fake photo by mistake, probably, and she said, "Oh, it doesn't matter. The message was important. It wasn't the photo." No, that does matter. Yeah. It does matter because, you know, if politicians and journalists can't get these things right, then we are going to get into a situation where, and this is why we've called this commission Truth and Trust in Technology, because the trust bit is really, really important. And trust, you know, is not a scientific thing. It's about relationship. It's about emotions and familiarity. You trust people just because you know them or you like them, not just because you think they're spot on, factually correct all the time. And that applies to politicians and journalists. And you shouldn't ever trust information. You should always be sceptical. But their trust as a sort of working relationship in society, there has to be some levels of common understanding, otherwise it all breaks down.
Yeah, and there's obviously a lot of responsibility on the part of people who are tweeting that and outlets that, that choose pictures to go with stories. I think there are some from older wars that have been used as recent examples. But so where does the responsibility of platforms come into that, to sort of choose whether to suppress that or let people make their own minds up?
It depends. Obviously, first of all, platforms are different. Google search has a interest in giving us accurate information because that's their business. You're searching for where is my local Tesco's. You actually do want the proper address. You don't want fake news about that. YouTube, which is also owned by Google, much harder problem there because they are more like Facebook. They're trying to generate content which is exciting, provocative, entertaining, and it's uploaded at such vast scale. Now, they already have, if you talk to them, they already have very strong obligations according to which country they're in. In the UK, there are, you know, laws about inciting racial hatred, offence, terrorism, defamation. You know, all these things kind of apply. What we're really interested, though, isn't it, is how much further they should go in sort of shaping the conversation. And we can ask YouTube to do things, and some of them are quite practical. The one around the kids, for example.
Yeah.
If you have a kids' channel, YouTube kids' channel, then really, guys, that should be super safe and thought through. On the other hand, the other bit, you don't want to... When I say I don't trust Google, YouTube to do this, I don't mean because I think they're untrustworthy. It's just it's a really difficult thing, for example, to decide, no, that video, which is shocking and disturbing and challenging and upsetting, should be allowed to stay because it's saying something important. That one over there, though, that is shocking and disturbing, is just trite, offensive and nasty. You know, now, we can make that choice. If I edit The Guardian, I can make that choice because it's my ball and I'm going home. You play by my rules. You know, it's my brand. quite different if you're a channel where the whole point of it is openness. And I think the brands, the news brands and every brand, university brands, political brands, have got a really important role to play here in that if the LSE is on YouTube, our brand can be trusted. And there are things that YouTube can do not to censor or remove, but at least to promote content. And this is going to be, this is a technological issue, is how do we match what you want? You may want different things to me. So how do the platforms allow for that?
Then there's particularly when it gets to political things, there's then a big censorship issue, because that's essentially what companies like Cambridge Analytica were doing. They were serving things to people based on very, very specific interests, but then they're allowed to manipulate that. So there's quite a difficult line there in serving to interests and exploiting that.
And there, you see, you're going there beyond what I would say is regulation, because the bit about regulation which says, I don't know, keep porn off. For example, Facebook's been very good at keeping porn off its network. There's an achievement. There's a regulatory bit which can say there are things we're definitely not going to do generally. Then there's the quality bit. Now this is, if you like, in a way that it's the truth bit of the commission, which is, we know there are certain facts and we can do fact checking and the platforms can do more about that. So can journalists, actually, you know. But then there's the bit about the quality. Is something provocative or is it offensive? What is important to know? What isn't important to know? How much should, as news organisations, we spend all the time deciding this is an important story, this isn't. This is an important voice. This is someone you should be hearing from. This one isn't. And we make those judgments and we're relatively transparent because you can tell the brand and what we've done. Fake news makes that harder because you never quite know what the source is and so on. So one of the first things that platforms can do is just help identify credibility better.
Yeah.
Just make sure that people know that is from, I don't know, the BBC, and that the BBC is a certain kind of organisation. So a little bit of transparency and promoting that kind of accountability would be helpful. I mean, what's fascinating is I've been doing this think tank thing for 10 years, and this year I've had more public interest than ever before. I think people are really worried because they make the connection, or really interested. They see interesting, weird stuff happening in politics, the rise of populism and so on, and some of them love it. But they also see this increasing importance of the social networks in their lives. We're so dependent now on our smartphones. You know, we need our Google Maps to move around and to shop and to do everything. And information is important. We're all expected to, you know, get mortgages, fall in love, send our kids to the right school, and increasingly we're doing it through these systems and influenced by them. So I think people do find it really more interesting before. They may not be so obsessed by the technical details of regulation, but I think partly this is the success. Let's remind ourselves. This is the success of the social networks, plus YouTube, plus search, is that it has given great power to people to entertain themselves, to inform themselves, to connect, as Mark Zuckerberg says, to other people, to get information from a more diverse range of sources than ever before, and to be able to respond back, to talk back, to challenge. People like this stuff.
That's one of your core pillars here, isn't it? Is media literacy.
Yeah.
Do you think that'll actually help if people become more media literate? Will they be more open to these organisations, or will they actually be more cynical? I saw a report the other day suggesting that actually they might.
Yeah.
Well, when they know how stories have been done, they might.
They've seen how the sausage is made. Yeah.
Might put you off a bit.
Yeah, I think that in some ways people feel a bit overwhelmed. There's a kind of abundance problem. They just want more help. I call it curation. You know, we live in a networked world. Facebook helps do that, and it also can show us more about how it does that. And people find it both fascinating, but also frightening. And this has always happened with new media technologies. And in many ways, fake news, if I dare use that phrase, has been great news for media literacy. Mm. We see real evidence, people connecting better with media organisations, people understanding better that, oh, something can be faked, and now is it faked? And they're asking better questions. How should I trust this? Why should I trust this? And you know, literary stuff, there's more stuff happening in schools now, for example. There are a whole bunch of things like the Carr Commission report, which, you know, where people are trying to respond to it. So, yeah, there's a real danger of cynicism, but I think the level of interest is great. I think that's how media literacy works.
This might be a bit of an impossible question, but have you got any practical tips for publishers to improve audience trust in what they do?
With so many, I mean, so many interesting projects going on around some really sort of techie things, like, you know, little widgets you can have, showing your sources, all those kinds of things. But I think there are two interesting ways, which I see a lot of publishers doing. You know, one is to be more accountable when you make a mistake, to admit it.
Even a font size slightly bigger than size 10.
That's right, not on page 86. And we're all bad at that. Mm. I don't like to admit when I screw things up, but it really does build confidence. And also to admit when you don't know something. I think it's a great practice that if journalists say, this is what we know so far, other people might know it better than us, actually. So helping your audience to get good information, perhaps from somewhere else, is useful. But the big bit, I think, is a really fascinating area, is this whole, you know, engagement, personalisation, membership, subscription, that you are, that the news brands are developing a different relationship, partly based on data. It might be based on people coming in for events and stuff. And that is a kind of responsibility. You know, you're creating a relationship that can, on one hand, should, you'd think, build trust and confidence and credibility. There are some downsides. I mean, journalists I know who work on in newsrooms which have become more subscription focused say there's also danger that you then actually have to do what your readers want.
Yes.
And if your readers are subscribing to a left-wing publication, they suddenly don't want to hear right-wing thoughts. Now that's interesting, because as a journalist you sort of have a responsibility sometimes, at least, to tell people things they don't want to hear, or to try and, you know, surprise people, give them opinions they may not agree with. That can be interesting too. So, you know, trust is not just about pleasing your customer in the short term. It's trust me, because I might tell you something you didn't want to hear, but it, yeah, you'll thank me for it. Ideally, you'll thank me for it by keeping your subscription going. You know, so I think it's thinking about those relationships. And I think, generally speaking, we're past the Leveson moment, I think. The phone hacking was the nadir for much of British journalism. I think journalists have got somewhat distracted by the fight for survival. Yeah. So some, of course, some brands have gone after the clickbait and the scale, and there's still going to be journalists you don't agree with or don't like. But I think that, generally speaking, that they realise that you have to build a more sustainable relationship. And that means just being careful when you start to do e-commerce or sponsored content and all those other grey area things, that you treat your audience with respect. And generally speaking, I think when you treat people with respect, then you build a relationship of credibility and trust.
Yeah. And I think what we finished by asking all our guests, what's the last thing you read or saw? It could be like a book or an article or a TV show that like really affected you.
Well, literally, the last thing, this is so self-indulgent, actually. John Gapper, who is a Financial Times writer, he's actually on our commission, and he wrote, I thought, a superb piece in the FT on Facebook. Not very surprising. Best thing I saw recently, it's not journalistic, is it? But I, Tonya. And that's interesting, okay, because I think it's interesting. I think it's a great film. And it has that sort of documentary feel to it, about a real story. And that's now how I think about that story, is from that film. I believe that story. That story for me is the truth. You know, the true story of that amazing episode. And there's a sort of truth there about, I don't know, life and America, that sometimes journalism you know, if we just do the facts, if you just do it in a scientific way, won't get that narrative across. And I think, you know, there is a kind of lesson, especially around visual journalism at the moment, that it is more emotional. It's more about trying to create human narratives, trying to have impact, even to the extent, like with I, Tonya, of using humour and violence and sex. This is all part of journalism now.
So that was a very cut down version of the interview I had with Charlie. But in Media Voices, we're releasing the full audio as a first, but only to our newsletter subscribers. Hint. So if you want to listen to that, you know what you've got to do. Go to our website, voices.media, and hit subscribe. Or if you're listening much later on and want to catch up with the full interview, you can tweet us at Media Voices Pod and we'll send it to you if you ask very nicely.
So thank you very much for listening this week. As ever, it's been a pleasure. Obviously, this is my first week back after a sort of extended hiatus, so it's great to get back into the swing of things with Esther and Peter. So yeah, please do remember that you can go to voices.media, sign up for our newsletter. There's the archive of our content on there, so you can go back and listen to any past episode with any one of our fantastic guests.
And don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter at Media Voices Pod.
So until next week, when we're going to be back with another fantastic guest, thank you and goodbye.
Bye.
Ta-ta-ta.